Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Kandinsky, a retrospective, is on right now through September 1st at the Art Institute in Milwaukee, the Milwaukee Art Museum. It's a collection of paintings and other works from the Pompidou in Paris, and it traces the development of this extremely interesting artist. The Pompidou is one of the major repositories of Kandinsky's work, and the collection came from the artist's widow. He lived during a turbulent time in history, World War I, Russian Revolution, and beginning of World War II, the rise of the Nazis. And he also was a deep thinker and author of a book that has been read by so many artists and people who are also deep thinkers concerning the spiritual in art. So in addition to looking at this exhibit, and you feel, at least I did, I didn't know much about him before our guest this hour took KP and me on a beautiful tour of the exhibit. It almost feels like you're seeing the art from a number of different artists, because what starts out to be looking like impressionism turns into a different kind of art by the end of the extremely complete exhibit. We're here to talk about Kandinsky this hour and also the exhibit that's on display at the Milwaukee Art Museum. Brady Roberts is our guest this hour. Brady would appear to be somewhat of a Kandinsky expert. He has written some essays that appear in the published book about Kandinsky, A Retrospective. He is the chief curator at the Milwaukee Art Museum. He is also the co-curator of this exhibit. So he oversees the museum's collections and exhibitions, the research, cataloging, care, display, and interpretation of the artworks. And he knows his Kandinsky pretty darn well, I must tell you. For those of you who know about the artist or have seen the exhibit, we are particularly interested in hearing from you this hour. Let me give you our phone number, 800-486-8655 is the number, 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. And Brady, thank you so much for being with us. It's so wonderful to learn new things, and I must confess that I just didn't know very much about him at all until this exhibit, and he is one interesting guy.
He's a fascinating artist, and I have to say that even art historians typically know Kandinsky for a very small period of his career from about 1906 to 1913, mm-hmm. and this retrospective shows the whole story from 1900 to 1944. So it was a real privilege to work with the Center Pompidou, which is such an amazing repository of Kandinsky's work, and to be able to tell this story completely and in a way that he's never been shown in the United States before. Mm.
I had the feeling when you took us through the exhibit, and just from hearing you talk about him, maybe you just study everybody with this kind of depth, but it seems to me as though you really found him fascinating, and that you've done an awful lot of work understanding who he was, the times in which he lived, what his thoughts were about art and the world, in addition to what we see in terms of the painting.
I've always been a fan of German Expressionism since my earliest college courses, and it's interesting. I had an art history professor, Jonathan Feinberg, at University of Illinois, who was someone who really inspired me to continue on in the field, and he did his dissertation on Kandinsky at Harvard many years ago, and he actually knew Nina Kandinsky, so he was sort of close to the source. But he opened my eyes to Kandinsky, you know, so many years ago. I don't want to say how many, but he's a professor emeritus now, so when we did the show, I called him up and I said, Jonathan, why don't you come and do the audio guide with me? And we did it together.
Great story.
And it's so funny because I continue to learn from him. He has such incredible insight, so it was really wonderful to have that little moment to be reunited around Kandinsky.
And he must have been proud of his former student, too, to see what you had done.
We had a nice time getting reacquainted.
I imagine. Let's talk a little bit about his book, about his thoughts. He begins the book, which I didn't have a chance to read all of it, concerning the spiritual and art, but I read some of it. He begins his book this way: every work of art is the child of its age, and in many cases the mother of our emotions. It follows that each period of culture produces an art of its own which can never be repeated. He seemed to have lived through a lot of different ages during his lifetime, didn't he? With World War I, with the Revolution, with the Nazis rising to power. And would it be presumptuous to say that his art seems to reflect all those different stages that he went through.
It does in many ways, and the particular period that you're referring to, this book was published at the end of 1911 and then republished immediately in 1912 after it sold out, and then that was the story that continued. It kept selling out, and they kept reprinting, and it's been in print since its original publication. But he spoke particularly of that period, even in the 1920s when he published his second major treatise, Point and Line to Plane. He said, looking back on that era right before World War I, he said, 1 year was like 10 years from another time. Mm. So he was acutely aware of what modernity meant. I mean, the whole shift from agrarian to urban society, the maturing of the Industrial Revolution, automobiles, airplanes, cinema, telephone. I mean, in many ways, that period was the beginning of the information age and the age of globalism that we live in today. And Kandinsky was keenly attuned to what this meant to society.
So when you put him in a category, if you can even do that, when you go through the early part of the exhibit, he looks like an impressionist painter, at least he did to my untrained eyes. By the end of the exhibit, you're into what to me is more abstract modern art. It's just amazing the difference between the beginning and the end of this exhibit, isn't it?
It is. And so the beginning is fascinating to me because when Kandinsky decided to become an artist, he was a little bit older than most people who make that decision. So he was right on the cusp of a legal career. He was going to be a university professor of law. He was 30 years old, and he saw an exhibition of contemporary French painting, and he saw an 1890s Monet haystack painting, and he knew he wanted to be a painter. So he went to Munich, which was the place you would go if you were a Russian, because there were a lot of Russians there, and he studied art. And, you know, it's an interesting story to see how he's first influenced and inspired by Impressionism, and then the next major chapter for him is going back to Paris in 1906 and seeing the work of Matisse and the Fauves, and he's really so struck by their color. And then he begins to invent a new language. But he really wanted from the outset to be an important artist who was creating a new paradigm, a new language in art, and a new form of spiritual art. And he refers to Russian icons in his paintings, their images. So he's giving us indications of what's on his mind as he's finding his way as an early artist. And then you see it's really after the 1906 Paris trip that he launches, and he becomes one of the key leaders of German Expressionism. So he's the co-founder of the Blue Rider group, Der Blaue Reiter, along with Franz Marc. And the other major German Expressionist movement is Die Brücke, the bridge, Ernst Ludwig Kirchner and a group of artists working in Dresden and then Berlin. The interesting thing for us is that Peg Bradley collected both of these schools and did it so well. So this is really how we were able to position ourselves so that we could co-organize this exhibition with the Pompidou. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the other thing that was really compelling to them was our building. They love the idea.
Got a good building.
And they, you know, they see it as beautiful, inspiring, and radical architecture, very much like their own. So they kind of see us as a sister institution. And they didn't know about our German Expressionist collection, though, but that's really what enabled us to work with them.
Yeah. Let's go back to when you say he became a painter a little later. It strikes me as really unusual for somebody to be almost becoming a law professor to then go into becoming an Impressionist painter and then a different kind of painter. Don't those seem like very different areas of interest, or is there a connection I'm missing?
Well, he was born into an affluent family. His father was a successful merchant, and Kandinsky went to university. He studied economics and anthropology and law. And when he was studying anthropology, he, as a project, went out into rural Russia, and he visited peasants, and he went into their homes, and they painted the insides of their houses as works of folk art. So the staircase, the banister, the furniture were all canvases, cupboards, you know. These were very colorful expressions. And that had a lasting impact on him. And it's something he would recall later when he created the mural room that we have in the exhibition during his Bauhaus years. It's something for him, he said it was like walking through a painting. But even before he made the decision to become an artist, he was pretty acutely aware of very sensitive to all sorts of different forms of art. And another impetus for him, another real inspiration, was going to see a Wagner opera, Lohengrin. Mm. And Wagner was very interested in a synthesis of the arts and bringing music together with theater and poetry and painting. Mm-hmm. And Kandinsky, of course, is very interested in synesthesia, the idea that you can hear color and that the artist is a composer conducting a symphony on canvas. And that's what he writes about in Concerning the Spiritual and Art, how a painting should really vibrate your soul, you know. So that's the kind of depth and spirituality that he sees as a possibility for a painting. And he really takes this to a very high level of idealism and utopian thinking right before World War I. He even really goes so far as to say the artist is a prophet leading the way into a new and greater world. Mm.
Let's talk about the mural. You mentioned it because it's one of the highlights of the exhibit. Certainly, it's all extraordinary. But walking into it's a nice description. Walking into this painting, it's a whole room, and it is walking into a painting. And it's the first time that's happened in this country, right?
Yeah. So it's an aspect of Kandinsky most people don't know. When he was invited to teach at the Bauhaus, his first position was the instructor of mural painting. And in the same year, this is 1922, he's also invited to create a mural for an exhibition in Berlin called the Jury Fry Exhibition. So that was the occasion where he created these murals. And what he did was he painted gouache studies. So he basically designed the murals, and then he worked with his students at the Bauhaus, and he had them paint these large. So the four major panels are 13 by 20 feet. They're quite large. And when you're painting a mural, this is the standard process. You design it and have other people help you execute it, or else, you know, it takes many years. So after the exhibition, the murals were lost. Nobody knows what happened to them. They may have been destroyed during World War II. We just don't know. They might have just been put in a closet and forgotten about. But when Nina Kandinsky was still alive, she worked with the conservators and curators at the Pompidou. And we have the photographs that show the students painting these murals. And we have the studies, and they have Kandinsky's notes at the Center Pompidou. So they were able to do very exact two-scale replicas of the mural room. And when the Pompidou opened in 1977, they presented these in the entrance lobby. And they've never been shown in the United States before. So we have them here at the Milwaukee Art Museum with the original gouache studies. We're the only venue in the United States that will have both together at the same time. So it's really a rare opportunity to see an aspect of Kandinsky that has never been seen in the United States. And, you know, the Guggenheim is a great repository for Kandinsky's painting. It did a major retrospective, and it was a wonderful show, but it didn't have this element. And the chapter that precedes the Bauhaus is also a little-known period in Kandinsky's career in Russia, when he had to leave Germany in 1914 at the outset of World War I. He went through some very tough years in Russia, but they were formative to his Bauhaus era. So we have this kind of complete story, and it's just so rare to be able to see every chapter unfold, because there is a progression to his career, and you can really understand how he did respond to these major world events, right, how they shaped his art in certain ways. And then at the end, the final chapter in Paris, he really transcended world events, and he decided he wasn't going to deal with the coming of the Second World War, the rise of Nazism. He did one painting in 1933 that is symbolic of the end of his stay at the Bauhaus and the rise of the brown shirts, the Nazis. And then he left it behind. He went to Paris, and he went into a world of his own imagination.
Yeah. He went in to see the light, didn't he? You talk about the Paris drawings at the end. He was really involved in seeing maybe it's a different kind of light in Paris, is it?
When he left the Bauhaus, he talked to his friend Marcel Duchamp, which is an interesting thing in itself, that these two artists were friends. If you look at their art, they seem extremely different, but actually Duchamp was one of the artists who was inspired by Kandinsky's text Concerning the Spiritual and Art. But he talked to Duchamp, and he said, listen, Nina and I want to move to Paris. Where should we go? And Duchamp advised him to move to Neuilly-sur-Seine, a suburb outside of Paris, and that's where Kandinsky went. And when he arrived, he was so struck by the quality of light in Paris, the beautiful diffuse light. And you see how how it influences paintings. The palette becomes much more pastel. So he is responding to a natural environment, even though he's creating, you know, fairly abstract paintings. Hmm.
Some journalist I was reading wanted him to come to the United States. Did he express an interest and was going to try to pave his way? Did he want to come here?
It's a very interesting thing because, you know, Kandinsky's teaching at the Bauhaus with luminaries like Marcel Breuer and Laszlo Moholy-Nagy and Josef Albers. And many of these artists did come to the United States. And you think of how Josef Albers really shaped so much of the post-war art world. I mean, the Albers color theory taught at Yale has influenced generations of artists, from Bryce Marden to young painters today who are still studying the Albers color theory. Kandinsky was invited to come to the United States, too. He had many invitations, but he was in his 70s, and I think he felt like he didn't want to be running at that point, and he decided to just stay in Paris. And when the Nazis occupied, they left him alone, which was fortunate. He was very worried in 1933 when he was in Germany. He was quite alarmed when Hitler became chancellor. And then later, Kandinsky was part of the Degenerate Art exhibition that Hitler organized in 1937. So he had reason, he had cause to be alarmed, and he was wise to leave immediately in 1933. But he was fortunate that when the Nazis occupied, they left him alone, and he was really free to paint right up until his final days. And his last paintings are beautiful. They're really exceptional. And it's amazing to see at the end of this exhibition how this artist pushed himself throughout his life to always constantly be creating new forms and new languages in art.
And did his audience accept that, or did they say, oh my gosh, what has he done? I don't even know who this guy is now.
After he published Concerning the Spiritual in Art, which coincides with his invention of really a new language in art, what Kandinsky learned from Monet and the Post-Impressionists and the Fauves, he really took to a much more psychologically engaging form of art. And he's also an amazing synthesizer. So he was looking at things as varied as ancient art, primitive art, Bavarian folk art, religious paintings, religious symbolism. And he put things together and created his own series of veiled symbols and created these amazingly beautiful color compositions that have all of this kind of musicality to them. So he was a great innovator and very important upon the publication of Concerning the Spiritual in Art, which very quickly became an international publication, but also as an innovator in the new language of art and really one of the first artists to be an abstract painter. And if you think of the abstract expressionists, they're influenced by both of these things. Kandinsky as a conceptual artist who's talking about how do you create an original voice that expresses your spiritual and emotional feelings. That's the project of every abstract expressionist, trying to invent a language where they can express who they are. Mm-hmm. And then formally, if you look at his colors and his compositions, his all-over compositions, his organic forms, you can see direct correspondence with Pollock and Arshil Gorky and others. And they loved him. They thought he was great. So, I mean, he was an important artist from 1912 forward. And by the time he got to Paris, that was big news because the surrealists were there, André Breton and Miró and Picasso, and whoa, hey, new guy came to town, another luminary in the field. So people were paying attention to him. And he wasn't a surrealist, although there were certain affinities, but he became part of a group called the Abstract Creation Group that included Piet Mondrian. That was sort of a counterpoint to surrealism, artists who were advocating more abstract painting.
We're talking this hour about the Kandinsky exhibit, which is at the Milwaukee Art Museum right now and runs through when, Brady? September 1st?
September 1st through Labor Day.
Through Labor Day. And it's getting rave reviews. And I think you mentioned the Guggenheim earlier. I had read that, I mean, they had sellout crowds they're mad. And people are mad now if they don't have a Kandinsky there because they're saying, where is he?
That's right.
He needs to be here. Yeah. It's a really interesting exhibit. Some of you, I'm sure, have seen it. It opened not all that long ago, but we welcome your phone calls about him because I'm sure many of you know a whole lot about him or you've seen this remarkable exhibit. Kandinsky, a retrospective on at the Milwaukee Art Museum. The co-curator of this exhibit is with us in our Milwaukee studio, and he is also the chief curator of the Milwaukee Art Art Museum, Brady Roberts. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter if you want to use that, and that's... I feel like I spent half the show saying all the places we are. But that's the last time I'll say this. At Twitter, at K Dunn Show. He wrote about, this book is really interesting, too, Materialism. And we'll talk about that more with Brady as we continue here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. If you want to join our conversation about Kandinsky, we certainly welcome you. Our number is 800-486-8655, and the email is talk@wpr.org. We have an email, Brady, from a fifth-grade teacher who wanted to know how to present Kandinsky with fifth graders.
Well, that's a great question. And as I said, Kandinsky was a great synthesizer and interested in so many forms of art. But one of the things he really loved was children's art. And he actually had children's art in his house, and you can see some direct correlations. And the professor I mentioned before, Jonathan Feinberg, actually wrote a book about influence of children's art on modernist painters, including Kandinsky. So I think that's a great introduction to see, you know, not only how, you know, young students can think about becoming a great artist someday, but how great artists are looking back at the inspiration that children provide them with their creativity, because they're just sort of unfiltered and unjaded, and they're something very pure. And that's what Kandinsky loved about Bavarian folk painting, too. I mean, these are people who are untrained and just giving a very genuine sort of expression. And that's what he was after, is how do I have a direct impact on the viewer through my colors and forms and this new language and art that he was inventing.
Mm-hmm. We go to Thomas in West Dallas. Hi, Thomas.
Hi there.
Hi.
Please excuse my laryngitis because it's really affecting my voice. But I wanted to ask Brady if amongst the images and works of art that are down at the Art Museum, is there included Kandinsky's first abstract image? It's a watercolor dated 1910, and it's simply called Untitled. I'm sure he knows which one I mean.
Yeah, so there's a whole issue around, you know, what is abstract, and Kandinsky had a view on that. He called his paintings non-objective because what look like abstract paintings are really veiled symbols for him. And I know the painting you're talking about, it's not in the exhibition, but there's a whole evolution of his style into increasingly abstract art. We don't see something that's really purely abstract until 1914. It's just that his symbols become so geometrically reduced and stylized that you don't know what they are unless you kind of study the evolution of those symbols. So it's kind of like reading a foreign language, and it's really fun once you crack the code. We have a great painting in the museum's collection that's in the exhibition that was donated by Peg Bradley. It's Composition 7 from 1913, and we've decoded that painting. So I think once you see in the video monitor how to read a Kandinsky painting, you begin to understand it's not so much abstract as it is this series of veiled symbols as he described them.
So how do you go about decoding it?
The best way is to really look at all of his earlier paintings and understand that this is an artist who was raised as a Russian Orthodox, and he's a deeply spiritual person. And what he's really thinking about is, I mean, he's very conscious of being alive in a new era, that industrialization and modernity is creating a different world than existed before. And what he's thinking about is, how do you make a spiritual painting at this time? And his observation about industrialization is that society was becoming very materialistic, and he became interested in theosophy and a sort of mysticism. And what he was trying to do was use art as a way to point towards a greater truth, a higher order that wasn't visible but that existed.
And he writes quite a bit about anti-materialism in that book, doesn't he?
He does. And one of the things that was very influential to subsequent generations of artists was Kandinsky's idea that art was not a recreation of the visible world, but was rather a vehicle for inner expression. And that's what so many artists found liberating from the abstract expressionists. Even to Marcel Duchamp, which is ironic. If you think of the artist who invented the ready-made, you would think he has no connection to, you know, a fairly romantic German expressionist painter. But it's this thesis and this idea that you could use art to express an inner vision that inspired Duchamp to give up painting and to be the author of the ready-made. So it really influenced, and, you know, Duchamp is sort of seen as the father of conceptual art. So this treatise concerning the spiritual and art is one of the key documents that later led to a more conceptual form of art.
Hmm. Thank you, Thomas, for your call. Mary in Madison, hi.
Hello. I just wanted to say two things that I really liked: the current exhibits and the permanent exhibits too. But I was wondering, you had gone so rapidly through the influences, you know, Bavarian folk art, and could you say that a little slower?
Oh, sure.
And also expand on the Bauhaus, when he joined it, and how he felt about that?
Sure. So first part is the influences. So when Kandinsky was really inventing himself as an important modern artist, after he had sort of absorbed the lessons of Impressionism, Post-Impressionism, and Fauvism, he was working with a group of artists who would become the Blue Rider group. And these are the artists that Peg Bradley collected that are so important to our collection of German Expressionism at the Milwaukee Art Museum. So it's Alexey Olensky and Gabriela Munter, August Macha, and then Franz Marc, and we borrowed a great Franz Marc painting from the Walker Art Center, Large Blue Horses. So these artists were interested in many ideas and many forms of art. So Bavarian folk art painting was very important, and they were doing a kind of painting called Hinterglasmalerei, which is reverse glass painting. So if you paint on the surface of glass and then turn it around and look at it from the back, it's very brilliant and shiny and gem-like with very dark, strong outlines. And if you look at Kandinsky's paintings from 1909, you'll see that aspect to them. So he's beginning to fuse intense fauve palette with Bavarian folk art painting. But he's also looking at African art, ancient art, all sorts of world art. And he and Franz Marc, when they form the Blue Rider group, they publish something called the Blue Rider Almanac. And you can pick this up now. It's still in print. Hmm. And if you flip through it, you'll see Kandinsky referring to religious European art, folk art, primitive art, etc. So, I mean, it's just very broad and diverse interest. And you can, I would suggest you pick up a copy of that and just leaf through it, and you'll see how varied his interests were at that time. And then, as I said, children's art, you know, he just found that to be wonderfully imaginative and pure and expressive. So that's kind of the influences, some of the things that inspired him as he was inventing himself. Now, regarding the Bauhaus and the rise of Nazism, this is really the tragedy of the Bauhaus, which is one of the great art schools of all time, one of the most important movements in modern art. It was opened in Weimar, and they had to close in 1925 because of conservative government in Weimar, including the Nazis. So they moved to Dessau, and this is where Walter Gropius, who was then the director, built his famous building. The Bauhaus building is a glass and steel and concrete building that's very skeletal and transparent. He thought of it as a factory building, but a factory for creativity. And it's an absolutely stunning piece of architecture. And the skeletal nature and transparency of the building is really the vocabulary of contemporary architecture today. So, I mean, I look at the Calatrava building at the Milwaukee Art Museum, and I see that same vocabulary in use. So that building in itself is an inspiration. And Kandinsky actually lived in a condominium designed by Walter Gropius for the master faculty at the Bauhaus. So he had a duplex that he shared with Paul Klee and his wife. And so it was Kandinsky and Nina in one half and Paul Klee and his wife in the other half. And it's in a park that's about a half a mile from the Bauhaus building. So, I mean, it's this most incredible environment. And then you have all of these brilliant instructors. But as this is unfolding, the Nazis are gaining more and more power. So there's this sort of ineluctable movement towards Nazism. Hmm. And what happens in 1933 is that the Nazis close the Bauhaus in Dessau, and the faculty moves to Berlin, including Kandinsky, but it's only there for a very brief time, a matter of months, before Hitler becomes chancellor, and that's the end. I mean, there's clearly hostility towards not only Jews but towards intellectuals and artists, and you know, subsequently Hitler organizes two exhibitions, the Great German Art Exhibition, which is a bunch of bad academic painters. And remember that Hitler is a failed art student, and he did not get into the Vienna Academy, which is a very prestigious academy. Vienna was a hotbed of anti-Semitism at the turn of the century, and that's where Hitler – that was sort of the forge for Hitler's twisted mind. So, I mean, this is a really interesting connection with Nazism and art, and it's clearly something on Hitler's mind when he organized the Great German Art Exhibition and then the Counterpoint, which is the – degenerate art exhibition, and what he was showing is that these are sick, twisted minds. So the funny thing is that the degenerate art show, which included Picasso and Braque and Matisse and Nolde and Beckmann and Kandinsky, was very well attended because it was a great show. And nobody went to the Great German Art Exhibition because it was a stinker, you know. So
it's funny. Yeah. Well, that was a pretty complete answer. Mary, thank you. Thank you very much for your call. We, if you want to join the conversation, 800-486-8655. When you took us through the exhibit, I can't remember what the name of the painting was, but you decoded for us the brown shirts. It was a picture that Kandinsky did, which gave us his views on Nazism in a way that you had to explain it to me. But when I saw it, I really saw it.
Yeah, when you enter the Bauhaus section, there's a brilliant, colorful painting, and it has steamships in it. It looks like an abstract painting, but again, you start looking closely, and this one you don't need to understand earlier paintings. You can see steamships, and if you follow his biography, to me, it's very clearly about this transportation to a new life from Russia, which was a very difficult period, to Germany, which was a great period. So you have these kind of curtains opening onto this new chapter in his life. That's the first major painting that he did in Weimar. The section concludes with the last painting that he did in Germany, which he took with him and finished in Paris, and it's called Development in Brown. And that's a very unusual title for Kandinsky. Mm-hmm. And the brown is the same brown as the uniforms of the brown shirts, the Nazis, as they were called at that time. And the imagery is a kind of a series of planes that look almost like doors that are shutting on a central image of a very colorful abstract painting, mm-hmm. very much like the first painting that he did in Weimar. And it's, you know, it's the end of this second great period of optimism in his career. So it is a dark moment. And then he gets to Paris and he's incredibly uplifted. And this is where he transcends the sort of world events at the end of his life. I think he decides, I'm not going to run. I'm an important artist. I have more to say. I don't really want to have anything to do with World War. I'm going to go to suburban Paris and I'm going to paint these beautiful pictures that are running through my mind. And they are the most lyrical and whimsical and humorous and childlike works. I should have mentioned that to the fifth grade teacher to focus on the last chapter, because these are beautiful childlike imagery that are really about the delicate balance and harmony of life. You know, they're really, really wonderful, uplifting paintings.
Helen in Madison, hi. Helen, are you there?
Oh, yes. Hi. Yes.
Hi.
I just wanted to ask if the speaker would address an issue. When the Bauhaus had to fold in Germany, they then moved and created a new Bauhaus in Chicago on North Dearborn Street in the, I believe it was the 40s, under Lazo Mahalinaji. And that had a bit of influence on design here in this country, and I just wanted to know if you would like to address that a bit.
Yeah, that's a very important chapter and an illustration of a broader trend. I mean, when the Nazis rose in power, Paris at that time was really the art center of the Western world. And with Nazism, it was so devastating to Europe in so many ways, but artists and intellectuals fled, and many of them came to the United States. The major chapters are all the artists that went to New York and really energized New York City and helped to create the catalyst for abstract expressionism. So that's kind of the major chapter. But the new Bauhaus, as you point out, founded by Laszlo Moholy-Nagy, which later became IIT, Illinois Institute of Design, with the great Mies van der Rohe building. And you look at Mies in Chicago, I mean, you know, some of the monuments of modernist architecture are Mies van der Rohe buildings in Chicago and surrounding areas like Plano. So it is this very important chapter in photography and in architecture in particular that impacts Chicago that is nationally and internationally significant. And this is what we were talking about earlier, that, you know, Moholy-Nagy went to Chicago, and Albers went to Black Mountain College and then to Yale, and they really shaped the, you know, the post-war art scene and are internationally important. And Kandinsky could have done the same thing, and I can't help but think, you know, what if Kandinsky taught at Yale with Albers? I mean, could you imagine the faculty with Albers and Kandinsky? I mean, you know, these Bauhaus instructors reunited. So not to be, but he was still incredibly influential.
Thank you. Interesting question, Helen. Eugene in Milwaukee. Hi.
Hello. Congratulations on this very historic and wonderful Kandinsky exhibit, which I've seen twice already.
Well, thank you so much.
I do have a question regarding his spirituality and his book, which I haven't read, concerning the spiritual art in art, if he has any connection with transcendentalism.
Well, he is interested in theosophy and in mysticism and Rudolf Steiner and Madame Blavatsky. So, and again, he's a synthesizer. So I think, you know, he never really lost being a Russian Orthodox, you know. So I think there is a sort of paradox to the sort of spirituality, the hybrid spirituality that he invented.
Thank you. I do have a second question.
Yes.
When he died in 1944, I believe it was.
Yes.
Was this, we just celebrated the 70th anniversary of Normandy, and was he around when the troops came into Paris to liberate Paris?
I think he died just before then, because I think that was 1945.
Yeah. Normandy was 1944, so maybe it took them a while to get to Paris.
Yeah, I don't know for sure, but I don't think he was in liberated Paris.
Thank you so much, and congratulations.
Thank you.
Thanks, Eugene, for the call. Our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And this hour, we're talking about the Kandinsky Retrospective, which is at the Milwaukee Art Museum now through September 1st. It's a wonderful exhibit. He was a man of deep thought, and his art just, you know, he's one kind of artist, and then another, and then another, and then another, and it's really riveting. Brady Roberts is our guest this hour. Brady is the chief curator at the Milwaukee Art Museum, and he is the co-curator of this exhibit. More phone calls momentarily on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's go next to Thor, interesting caller from Ellison Bay. Hi, Thor.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm a potter and have been for some 40 years. I was a student at Luther College and went on to spend 3 summers with Marguerite Wildenhain at Tahn Farm in California. And she was one of the original students of pottery at the Bauhaus, which many people don't realize there was such a thing. But I must say that I practice the lessons I learned from her every day.
And what are they?
Well, it's you know, the form follows function was sort of the model that we learned and had drummed into our heads. And she also had a very sort of particular kind of underglaze decorating that many of her students, in fact, most of her students, have adapted, and I use that all the time. So my work is quite decorative and quite sculptural at the same time, which is sort of makes a Bauhaus or a Marguerite student identifiable.
We did a show of Greta Marx at the museum maybe a year and a half ago. I don't know if you caught that. She was a Bauhaus-trained ceramics artist who set up her own kind of industrial fabrication. She was Jewish, so she got shut down by the Nazis too, but moved to London. And, you know, continued to create, but the sort of the strength of her work after that experience was not so good. There's an interesting painting in the Bauhaus section of our exhibition that's done with spray paint. And there were a lot of ceramics artists who were doing spritz decor, which is, you know, the airbrushed painting. So there was this, you know, I mean, the kind of spirit of borrowing and learning from your peers at the Bauhaus really comes across in you know, in that phase of the Kandinsky retrospective, and you can see some crossover even with ceramics artists.
Well, throughout this country, there's probably, I don't know, probably 80 to 100 former Pond Farm students quietly scattered around the country practicing their craft. But whenever you get a chance to see them, it's always a treat because everyone sort of took a different lesson from Marguerite, but has sort of applied their own twist to it. But the quality is always there, and the functionality. So it was a great time, and she was an incredible teacher. So
yeah. And
anyway, I just wanted to share that.
Thank you, Thor.
That's very interesting. And you know, another interesting thing is that, of course, that's what the Bauhaus is all about, or sort of universal design principles that would apply to any form of art or architectural, especially industrial design. So they're very interested in sort of multidisciplinary approach. And when Gropius invited Kandinsky to teach, he sort of bypassed the normal process and did it unilaterally. And many people were sort of upset that Kandinsky, who was just a pure painter, I mean, he wasn't cross-disciplinary. And, you know, when Kandinsky painted the mural room, he sort of used that as a fig leaf for, you know, see, I've united painting with architecture. But he really was a painter's painter.
Thank you so much, Thor, for the call. Sarah in Zion, hi.
Hi, thank you. Listen, speaking of war, I was wondering, I remember learning about how World War One, with its, you know, its absurdity and destruction, influenced writers and artists a great deal. And I was wondering if there's anything about Kandinsky that you can trace to World War One, and if you feel like it, if you could tell me more about just the art world in general's reaction to World War One.
Yeah, it's a great question, and it's a hugely important chapter for visual artists, and also in literature and music and architecture in so many ways. So what you'll see in the Kandinsky show is that right up till 1913, there's this incredible optimism and utopian spirituality to his painting. And then all of a sudden, his abstract paintings are like he's looking into an abyss, you know, so you can see that he is psychologically shaken. And there's an interesting thing that happens when he goes to Russia, in that he returns to Impressionism, which is really shocking for an artist whose whole project up to that point has been about inventing a new language in art and pushing the paradigm of modernism. To return to a style invented in the 1860s seems completely out of character, but actually this was an international movement. There was a return to classicism, a return to classical order, a return to stability of earlier times. So in Germany, into the 1920s, you see a return to old master painting, to Rembrandt and Albrecht Dürer, and so the whole new objectivity movement, as it's called, the Neue Sachlichkeit, they're looking at old master painting. So you have a return to figuration. If you think about Cubism and German Expressionism, it's like a very creative and energetic destruction of form. And what happened in World War One is nobody knew how intense and devastating and widespread the destruction of the first industrially mechanized war would be. And, you know, 10 million soldiers died, 10 million civilians died. Society was in a state of shell shock, right? So the idea of fragmenting through artistic language was no longer interesting. It was a time of rebuilding, and you see that reflected internationally. You even see it in the United States. There's a return to classicism. Picasso is the great example, because before the war, he's doing analytical and synthetic cubism. He's, you know, he's fragmenting geometrically what he observes. And after the war, he's returning to classical figures and classical mythology.
Interesting. Were they buddies at all, Picasso and Kandinsky?
No, they were in Paris together, and they were aware of each other. But, you know, when you go through the Kandinsky exhibition, we have lots of photographs of him, and you see someone who's very formal and proper and looks sort of unapproachable. And that was his facade, and I think he wasn't a big one to reach out. The students that studied with him, many felt him to be pretty cool and aloof. Those who got to know him well said he was a wonderful and warm, deep human being. But I think it wasn't in his nature to go out and try to be friends with other leading artists. And an interesting thing in concerning the spiritual and art is that he respects Picasso, but he also takes some shots at him, you know. So he's really gunning for being the lead artist. He's very conscious of the hierarchy in artistic society, and he talks about the form of the pyramid and the artist at the top of the pyramid, the very few, the elite, and he really wants to be at the top of the heap.
Was he?
In many respects, yes, but so was Picasso. I mean, there wasn't one king of the mountain. But, you know, we look back at the history of art, and it's an incredible period of modernism before and after World War I and the way that the avant-garde shifted with this major societal disruption. But in Paris, you have this incredible lineage. I mean, it goes all the way back to Delacroix and the Romantics, and then you have Monet and the Impressionists, who are the next radicals. These are all radicals who are challenging the academic norm, and they're inventing their own language in art, and it becomes progressively more radical and abstract. And then you have the post-Impressionists, Van Gogh, Gauguin, Seurat, Cézanne, who's just hugely influential. And then, you know, you go right into Cubism and Fauvism. So, I mean, you know, there's 100 years of French painting that's just amazing in its innovation and challenging the norms. And the critics are just, you know, baffled by all of these artists that we now accept as, you know, the most lovely and lyrical artists were, you know, considered just crazy people then. And then, you know, in Germany, the Expressionists, the Brucke artists and the Blaureiter artists are very inspired by this and invent their own language that's much more psychologically engaging and penetrating. Hmm.
And tell me, Brady, about what happens to bring this collection here. Did you go to the Pompidou and say, I'd like this, 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 and this, and arrange how it was all going to take place? Are there certain paintings that cannot leave Paris? How do you arrange such a massive exhibit?
Well, there was a certain serendipity. I was in Paris on some other business, going to an art fair called FIAC, which is a contemporary art fair. A collector friend invited me to come along, and I thought, hey, as long as I'm in Paris, I should probably touch base with colleagues there. So I arranged to visit the Pompidou. And like I said, they love our building. They know us for the building. They don't know us for our collection. So the building opened the door, and then once I was there, I learned that they were organizing a Kandinsky retrospective to travel to the United States, and they would love for it to go to Milwaukee. Ah. And I said, you know, let me tell you about the Peg Bradley collection, because if we put our collections together, the show would be so much better. So that's when I got together with Angela Lampa and a great person at the Pompidou, Alex Kaliex, who's now moved to the Foundation Giacometti in Paris. And we really, put this thing together in pretty short order. It's nice. I mean, there's a certain streamlined aspect when you have a repository like they do at the Pompidou and the Bradley collection. We had almost the whole story right there, and we just borrowed three other paintings, one from the Art Institute, one from the Guggenheim, also a 1913 painting like Peg Bradley's, a great painting called Small Pleasures, and then this amazing masterpiece by Franz Marc from the Walker Art Center, and there was our show. So, I mean, that part we could get a handle on pretty quickly. We had to produce a catalog, too. That's like a whole nother project. So, yeah. I mean, 3 years was just enough time to do the things that we had to do. And then I had, you know, there are a great team of people that arrange for the shipping, which is no small feat for a transatlantic exhibition, designing the exhibition, including this very powerful mural room that they hadn't installed at the Pompidou in some time. So they're working with my exhibition designer, David Russick, and trying to map out the most efficient way to install that. And, of course, all of their instructions were coming in metric. And, you know, plenty of pitfalls in that process that were all avoided. David did a brilliant job. The team does a great job. I mean, it's all the all the difficult things that you never see or hear about because the team really, you know, pulls them off in such a seemingly effortless fashion. But so it was great collaboration between the two institutions.
Well, the end product is spectacular, and congratulations on it. It was wonderful.
Thank you.
Well, it is. I'll go back sometime. Thank you. Thanks, Brady.
My pleasure.
And thanks to all of our callers on this. The exhibit will be there, the Kandinsky Retrospective at the Milwaukee Art Museum until September 1st. We should also remind you, go to their webpage because I think it's really wonderful. They have all these other lectures that are taking place too, which is great. Yeah, Brady?
I just want to point out that Jonathan Jackson, the director of Milwaukee Film Festival, is going to do a program on August 14th. He's presenting some film shorts from the same period as Kandinsky that
wonderful.
Are a great tie-in to the paintings.
Great, thanks. Thanks to KP Whaley for producing this hour, and thanks to Lisa Nalbandian for on-air production. I have some other responsibilities tomorrow, so John Munson is going to be filling in for me, discussing a new book about Wisconsin's progressive trailblazers, and he will also be talking about tobacco companies, so that's coming up tomorrow. Thanks for listening, everybody. Thanks to Lisa and to KP.